Texans are hospitalized for the coronavirus. Average new deaths stayed the same compared with the seven-day average a week ago. On October 11th, 31 new deaths were reported. West Texas Intermediate this Monday is trading at $39.33, down $1.27. Now let's look at coronavirus briefs. More than half of U.S. states are seeing an increase in new coronavirus cases, with five states reporting a jump of more than 50% in 1 week. U.S. coronavirus death rates are high, even compared to other countries with high death rates. North Dakota has less than 20 beds available as COVID-19 cases surge, public health official says. At least 214,000 people have died of the coronavirus in the United States since February. More than 7,728,000 cases have been reported. Landlords, apartment owners, and housing industry groups have launched a legal war against the Trump administration's moratorium on evictions, leaving millions of families once again facing the risk of homelessness in the middle of a deadly pandemic. President Trump on Monday pointed to recent increases in coronavirus cases in Europe to argue that countries there are faring poorly relative to the United States. Cases there have spiked recently, but much of Europe managed to return to a new normal last summer after implementing stringent restrictions early in the crisis, unlike the United States. Here are short articles. Marfa schools close after students and staff member test positive for COVID-19, from Marfa Public Radio. Five students and one employee at Marfa Independent School District have been diagnosed with the coronavirus, forcing officials to close the district's two campuses and shift to remote instruction for the next week. In a letter sent out to parents and guardians on Friday, the district superintendent, Oscar Aguero, outlined the timeline of events. The district will be closed Monday through Friday this week as officials shift to remote instruction for all students. During this time, campus officials say facilities will be disinfected according to their reopening plan. Both of Marfa's schools will reopen for in-person instruction Monday, October 19. The closure at Marfa ISD comes the same day as Alpine Independent School District announced students at Alpine High School may have been exposed to a person diagnosed with coronavirus. New coronavirus cases are up by at least 50% in five U.S. states. More than half of U.S. states are seeing an increase in new COVID-19 cases, with five states, Montana, New Mexico, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Vermont, reporting a jump of more than 50% in 1 week. Only Maine, Texas, and Washington are reporting fewer new daily cases on average from last week. USC's highest number of daily coronavirus cases since August. The recent uptick in coronavirus cases across the United States has emergency physicians fearing it could represent the start of a dreaded second wave. We are all seeing increasing numbers of COVID-19 patients who are coming into our ERs who are getting really sick, requiring hospitalization and even intensive care, Dr. Megan Ranney, an emergency room physician and Brown University associate professor, told CNN's Erica Hill. We are all deeply afraid that this is the beginning of that dreaded second wave, she said. There were 20% more deaths than expected in the U.S. from March to August, research finds. There were 20% more deaths than expected in the United States from March 1st through August 1st, with COVID-19 officially accounting for about two-thirds of them, according to new research published Monday in the medical journal JAMA. Although total U.S. death counts are remarkably consistent from year to year, U.S. deaths increased by 20% during March through July 2020, said the research, authored by Dr. Stephen Wolf and colleagues at the Virginia Commonwealth School of Medicine. COVID-19 was a documented cause of only 67% of these excess deaths. There were at least 1,336,561 deaths in the U.S. between March 1st and August 1st, the study found, a 20% increase over what would normally be expected. Of the approximately 225,530 excess deaths, at least 150,541, or 67% of them, were attributed to COVID-19. Analysis found that there were increases in deaths related to causes other than COVID-19, including the U.S. mortality rate for heart disease, which increased between the weeks ending March 21st and April 11th, driven by the spring surge in COVID-19 cases, and mortality rates for Alzheimer's disease and dementia, which increased twice. Regeneron treatment Trump received won't be widely available to public, CEO says. The antibody treatment that President Trump was given after his coronavirus diagnosis will likely not be widely available to the country, according to the CEO of the company that manufactured the medical concoction. Regeneron CEO Leonard Schleifer told CBS News' Face the Nation on Sunday that there are not enough doses of its product to be widely distributed among the public. Schleifer told Margaret Brennan that the distribution deals will be worked out by the government, the Food and Drug Administration, and the ethical experts to give the products to those most in need, such as the elderly and those in high-risk categories. We have to figure out ways to ration this, he said. President Trump inaccurately called the treatment a cure last week and said he wanted to make Regeneron accessible to patients at no cost. He added that he had emergency use authorization all set. The president made the announcement shortly before the company actually applied for the emergency use authorization. Trump is on the short list of people who have used the experimental drug derived from fetal tissue. The real impact of a drug comes from how it can perform on average in large clinical trials that are ongoing, Schleifer said. We've got some preliminary evidence that we've talked with the FDA, and we're going for an emergency use authorization because we think it's appropriate at this time, he said. But yes, the president's case is a case report, perhaps the most analyzed case report ever. And this note, once again, later in our show today, we'll be bringing you a recorded report. This is actually going to be the audio from a 60-minute segment that aired last night regarding these types of treatments. Imperative political pressure not lead to premature authorization of antibody treatment, Doggett says. In a letter sent Friday to top U.S. health officials, Representative Lloyd Doggett, a Democrat from Texas and chair of the Ways and Means Health Subcommittee, expressed his concerns regarding the safety, effectiveness, transparency, and affordability of Regeneron's antibody treatment. The letter addressed to U.S. Food and Drug Administration Commissioner Dr. Stephen Hahn, U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar, U.S. Department of Defense Secretary Mark Esper, and Operation Warp Speed Chief Advisor Manshif Slaoui, Doggett explained the need for scientifically proven and independently reviewed emergency use authorizations, EUAs, and regulatory approvals. The congressman's letter, shared exclusively with CNN, comes after President Trump posted a video to his Twitter account on Wednesday saying the treatment's emergency use authorization is all set. Also on Wednesday, Regeneron applied to the FDA for an EUA for its COVID-19 antibody therapy. Doggett also stated that the president has reportedly spoken directly with Hahn to urge immediately authorization, adding, it is imperative that political pressure not lead to premature authorization. Taxpayers deserve access to a treatment whose development they funded after it satisfies science-led safety standards, Doggett said in a press release. He added that it is essential to guarantee strong guardrails to protect safety, access, and affordability. The letter notes American taxpayers have invested more than $500 million in the treatment, which went to research, development, and manufacturing operations. Doggett submitted written questions concerning the EUA process, manufacturing, distribution, and pricing for the health officials to address. Doggett requested a commitment to publicly release all clinical trial data, safety, and efficacy data, and any accompanying analysis at least a week prior to any authorization or approval. A commitment to providing unredacted manufacturing agreements between the federal government or subcontractors and Regeneron, and unredacted research and development funding agreements between the federal government or its subcontractors and Regeneron. American taxpayers have assumed all of the risk in this endeavor, and in return, taxpayers should receive a safe, effective, and affordable product, Doggett said. Fauci says he was taken out of context in new Trump campaign ad touting coronavirus response. Dr. Anthony Fauci did not consent to being featured in a new advertisement from the Trump campaign touting President Donald Trump's handling of the coronavirus pandemic. Instead, the nation's leading infectious disease expert told CNN his words were taken out of context. In my nearly five decades of public service, I have never publicly endorsed any political candidate. The comments attributed to me without my permission in the GOP campaign ad were taken out of context from a broad statement I made months ago about the efforts of federal public health officials, Fauci said in a statement provided exclusively to CNN when asked if he agreed to be featured in the ad. The Trump campaign released the new ad last week after the president was discharged from Walter Reed National Military Medical Center following treatment for COVID-19. The 30-second ad, which is airing in Michigan, touts Trump's personal experience with the virus and uses a quote from Fauci in an attempt to make it appear as if he is praising Trump's response. President Trump is recovering from the coronavirus, and so is America, the ad's narrator says. Together, we rose to meet the challenge, protecting our seniors, getting them life-saving drugs in record time, sparing no expense. The ad then flashes to an interview with Fauci in which he says, "I can't imagine that anybody could be doing more." Though no date is provided in the ad, Fauci's quote is from an interview with Fox News in March. During that interview, Fauci praised the White House Coronavirus Task Force's round-the-clock effort to respond to the pandemic, which he says included numerous White House meetings and late-night phone calls. White House Economic Advisor Mnuchin may go above $2.2 trillion in stimulus offer. White House Economic Advisor Larry Kudlow said on Sunday that he doesn't think the prospect on another round of coronavirus relief is dead at all, and that Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin may offer a proposal priced higher than Speaker Nancy Pelosi's most recent offer of $2.2 trillion. Secretary Mnuchin is up to $1.8 trillion, so the bid and the offer is narrowing somewhat between the two sides. President Trump actually always said, I've heard him say this in the Oval, as far as the key elements are concerned, the checks, the unemployment assistance, the small business assistance, we've got to help airlines out. He would go further. He's always said that, Kudlow said. Kudlow said he spoke with Mnuchin Saturday night on the matter. He noted that the Republican asked for targeted relief measures, including more federal unemployment assistance and another round of PPP loans and direct stimulus checks to individuals. They have bipartisan support. We could do it as standalone bills or an omnibus bill or whatever, but I do not understand the intransigence from my Democratic friends, Kudlow said, casting the blame on Democrats, even though many Senate Republicans have been resistant to deal with a high price tag. On Saturday, Senate Republicans blasted a $1.8 trillion offer from the White House on a call with Mnuchin and White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. While the sentiment was that talks with Pelosi should continue, it was clear that the White House plan had virtually no chance of passing the Senate, per multiple sources. Asked about the Republican pushback, Kudlow demurred, saying, "I don't know who we have lost," and noting that the previous Republican efforts on a pared-down bill. "Let's see what happens. I'm not negotiating today," Kudlow said. This also comes after President Donald Trump did an about-face on the negotiations last week, first unilaterally putting a stop to the talks ahead of the election, and then signing off on a $1.8 trillion proposal by Friday. Kudlow reiterated his belief that the economic recovery is not dependent on the passage of another stimulus bill. Incredible whiplash. For U.S. airline workers, talk of crisis for transit as uncertainty over stimulus persists. U.S. airline executives and workers ended an exhausting and turbulent week, uncertain about their future, as a bipartisan push for federal payroll aid for the ailing industry fizzled in the face of a broader struggle over how the federal government should boost the nation's pandemic-stricken economy. Yet, even as airlines' pleas for swift assistance went unanswered and deep layoffs continued, other parts of the hard-hit U.S. transportation industry found their severe problems back in the mix just days before President Trump on Tuesday declared stimulus talks over until after the election. By Friday, his administration was back preparing for a roughly $1.8 trillion plan. With the White House now negotiating with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi over a broader deal, aid for bus drivers, train operators, and flight attendants is again part of a wider conversation about potential financial assistance for millions of unemployed Americans and small businesses ravaged by the nation's failure to control the pandemic. Shifting from the airline industry to the restaurant industry, we have this story from the Washington Post that was published last week. Restaurant industry scrambles for solutions as Trump administration waffles on stimulus talks. On Saturday, as he was being treated for the novel coronavirus at Walter Reed, President Trump hit the caps lock and tweeted, "Our great USA wants and needs stimulus. Work together and get it done." On Tuesday, he reversed course and cut off relief negotiations with House leaders, sending the stock market tumbling and creating panic among citizens and businesses hoping for a cash infusion to survive the pandemic. The hospitality industry in particular has been lobbying hard to pass the $2.2 trillion HEROES Act, which includes a revitalization fund that would provide $120 billion to help independent restaurants and bars with fewer than 20 locations. Members of the Independent Restaurant Coalition, an industry trade group, recently said 85% of their peers could close by the end of the year without federal relief. The IRC sent out a statement following Trump's decision to halt stimulus negotiations between Secretary Steven Mnuchin and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi until after the election on November 3rd. If Congress and the President walk away from negotiations, even more of our neighborhood restaurants will go out of business, the organization wrote. Restaurant employment decreased in 9 states in the last available report, and this industry remains the largest contributor to national unemployment. We cannot afford 5 or 6 more weeks of decreased revenue, more debt, and uncertainty about colder weather. Chefs and restaurateurs reacted with anger, frustration, and resignation to the stalled talks. The timing couldn't be worse for many operators, particularly those in colder climates where patios are beginning to close and patrons must decide whether they feel safe dining indoors. The evidence suggests it may not be safe. People are getting screwed over because you have a group of people who are running our country who care more about power than they care about people, said Tom Colaccio, the IRC co-founder and man behind Crafted Hospitality, in an interview with the Washington Post. "At this point, I'm losing money. Staying open makes no sense," Colaccio continued during a break in Top Chef, filming in Portland, Oregon. "Maybe for the next month we can hang in there and break even. But once it gets too cold and everybody goes back inside and we're at 25% inside, and quite frankly, looking at the infection numbers in New York go up, there's going to be a decision pretty soon to shut everything down again. What are we going to do then?" he added. Colaccio said money from the revitalization fund would have supported his operations for 6 months, perhaps long enough to see a vaccine hit the market. He and his peers, Colaccio said, had been essentially banking on the stimulus cash. "I'm telling people that we owe money to, like, hey, you know what? This is going through. We think we're going to get something. Just hang in there. We'll take care of you as soon as we get money. I mean, this is really going to hurt." David Chang, the chef and multimedia star, first lashed out with an expletive on Twitter, then composed himself for a follow-up comment. "Politics overdoing what's right. Incredibly wrong." Pastry chef Tiffany McSalick, owner of the Buttercream Bake Shop in Washington, D.C., went through a cycle of emotions in one short tweet. Anger, followed by panic, followed by deeping diver into pivot. I hate that word. Ideas, she wrote. Chef, restaurateur, and TV personality Andrew Zimmern, who has predicted an extinction event for restaurants without federal aid, was even more pointed in his comments. This isn't about you and your ego, your selfish desires, your trophy case. This is about the economy of the United States and all her citizens, Zimmern tweeted. More sickeningly, it's hostage-taking. It's the tool of the bully autocrat. Kamala Marcus, a founding member of the IRC, recently had to shut down Westbourne, her socially conscious cafe in New York's Soho neighborhood, but she has not lost her faith. Restaurants cannot give up hope, she wrote in an email statement to the Post. It's hard to imagine that our government turns a blind eye and refuses to help independent restaurants when so many are teetering on the verge of extinction. I was forced to close mine because there was no plan of assistance. But today a plan is within reach. The House passed our Restaurant Revitalization Fund proposal, which also has the support of over 41 senators from both parties. This is not political. This is about people. Marcus, who holds a business degree from the Wharton School, said the IRC will continue to fight for the revitalization fund so other restaurants won't have to follow in the path of Westbourne. In a short amount of time, there will be no restaurant industry. Tom Brown, a veteran bar owner in Washington, D.C., wrote in a Facebook comment, "Best bet? Make a business plan in the short term. Look for cheap rents in the summer of 2021. And build out winter 2021-2022 for a spring 2022 opening, if there are investors left to court, that is." With a restaurant industry that has shed millions of jobs since the pandemic started and is expected to lose $240 billion this year, some never expected the government to bail them out. "I gave up on the idea that anyone was coming to save us as an industry back in April," Ian Bowden, chef and owner of The Shack in Staunton, Virginia, wrote on Facebook. "We like are always on our own." Bobby Stuckey, co-founder of the Frasca Hospitality Group with restaurants in Denver and Boulder, Colorado, sent an email to the Post saying, "I have received countless texts from people in the industry who are crushed by this news. The uncertainty is killer for many businesses who have been accumulating tons of debt for months. With colder temperatures making outdoor dining impossible, no vaccine in sight, and rising positivity rates in many states, many restaurant owners have no choice but to close." It's hard for restaurateurs to know exactly where the Trump administration stands on a stimulus package, particularly after the president reversed course again late Tuesday, in a string of tweets saying he was ready to sign at least a partial stimulus package for Americans and small business. Trump previously said that, "Immediately after I win, we will pass a major stimulus bill that focuses on hardworking Americans and small business." But he is also trailing in the polls. Many speculated that should Trump lose, an economic stimulus package may not arrive until after Joe Biden is inaugurated in January. There's been no indication right now whether or not, in a lame duck session, he would pass a relief bill, said Colicchio. "You would think that the Republicans, even post-election, would want to have some sort of win, and they can say they pushed this through, but who knows?" Representative Earl Blumenauer, Democrat, Oregon, who introduced the original Restaurants Act, said he's still working with colleagues on both sides of the aisle to get legislation passed in the House and Senate. Despite the tweets, restaurant relief is still very much in play as the administration tries to make sense of Trump's incoherent positions, the congressman said in an email to the Post. He's already walked back some of his comments after massive blowback. "I think we'll see the same with restaurant relief, given the broad bipartisan support and urgent need in the industry." Now we'll move to our pre-recorded reports. Our first two reports are from the Texas Standard, and they both relate to the election. Our first story is, "Where's my mail-in ballot?" The story that will directly follow is "The Big Flip, How the Pandemic Makes It Hard to Predict Who Will Control the Texas House."
Since we've been talking about absentee ballots, we should address one of the elephants in the room here, namely, how is mail-in voting supposed to work? From now until Election Day, our Texas Decides project has been answering your questions about voting. And today, the Standard's own Shelley Brisbane takes us on the journey of an absentee ballot.
Sarah Goodman sent her application for a mail-in ballot before the primary election in March. The 68-year-old Austin resident opted to vote by mail because of COVID-19. On her application, she checked the box that would make sure she'd receive a mail-in ballot for all elections this year. Her question for Texas Decides is about her November 3rd ballot.
I would like to know when Travis County is going to be mailing out the mail-in ballots. So I want to know when I should expect to receive it.
Right now, the answer is unclear. Normally, there are a lot of steps along the way between requesting your mail-in ballot and having it counted. And this year, requests for absentee ballots are at an all-time high, says Travis County Clerk Dana DeBeauvoir.
We did have about 63,000 total by mail requests.
And it's not just in Austin.
For lack of a better word, we're drowning in applications to vote by mail.
Malin Huntley is election administrator for Potter County, which encompasses part of Amarillo. She says there are a lot of steps to verifying eligibility and preparing a ballot.
Once we receive the application, of course, you have to make sure that they are registered to vote. You make sure that the application is in Potter County, and assuming everything is filled out as it's supposed to be, then it is received into one of our software systems where we track every step of the vote-by-mail process.
Huntley's staff compares the signature on the application to their copy of the voter's registration card, and then they assemble a packet.
It includes a carrier envelope, a ballot envelope, the green envelope in which the ballot goes. There's a letter from the Secretary of State. There's some special instructions for this year, and there's a ballot in there.
Travis County's Dana DeBeauvoir says she's been mailing ballots out to voters in waves. But Sarah's still wondering where her ballot is. What she didn't know is that there is a way for her to find out.
Go to votetravis.com. They'll see a button that says voter lookup, and you press the button, capital BBM status.
BBM stands for ballot by mail, and you'll have to scroll a bit to find it. Turns out Sarah's application is on file, but her ballot hasn't been mailed to her yet. Unfortunately, not all Texas counties provide this kind of online lookup. Go online or call your county elections office to find out if yours does. When her ballot arrives, Sarah will be able to make her choices, sign it, and mail it back, and it must be postmarked by Election Day. But Sarah isn't taking any chances.
We've already seen that there's places where you can drop off your mail-in ballots effective October 1, yet I don't even have my mail-in ballot yet.
She says when she gets that ballot, she plans to drive the 15 miles from her home to Travis County's main office to deliver it in person.
Voters can drive up, show ID, sign a signature roster, and then put their by-mail ballot directly into the ballot box.
It's important to remember that you can't deliver a mail-in ballot to a polling place, and you can only deliver your own ballot. Once Sarah drops off her ballot, it goes into the hands of election staff.
There's a long-standing procedure for ballot by mail that is very tedious and very manual. Everything with by mail, there's nothing automated about by mail.
Workers pull the sealed ballot envelope out of the outer envelope, the one with the voter's identification information. They unseal the ballot and prepare it for scanning. Then they lock it in a vault. Staff then use the information from the outer envelope to update the roster of mail-in voters.
Once we start in on early voting, we are required to upload the list of everybody who voted to the Texas Secretary of State. And so you can go in there and you will know that we have received your ballot.
Ballots won't be tallied until Election Day, but Sarah and other voters can track the status of their ballots by going online to votetexas.gov. County election officials say that if you want to reduce the chance of something going wrong along the way, the best thing you can do is to mail in or hand deliver that ballot as soon as possible. For the Texas Standard, I'm Shelley Brisbane.
For the first time in nearly 20 years, Democrats have a real shot at winning a majority in the Texas House of Representatives. There are a lot of reasons why Democrats are hopeful about their chances this fall, but actually predicting what will happen this election is harder than ever. As part of her series, The Big Flip, KUT Austin's Ashley Lopez explains why.
That's because there's so many variables. And during this upcoming election, there are a truly staggering amount of variables. That's why it's kind of impossible to say for sure whether Democrats will actually flip the Texas House. And a lot of these wild cards have to do with how or if people will vote. To show you what I mean here, let's bring in Andrew Weber. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Belle.
Okay, Andrew, let's play a scenario out. Let's say, I mean, this is all, like, we don't know what's going to happen, so that's why I'm just going to throw a bunch of stuff at you. So let's say the Supreme Court lets all eligible voters in the state vote by mail. Like, last minute, this ruling comes down, and they can vote if they want to. What would you do? If you had the option of voting by mail or voting in person, like, what would be your choice?
If I had the option, I would definitely vote by mail.
Okay, so let's say the election goes on as we kind of assume it will. Voting in person is probably going to be the way most people vote. What do you think your plan's going to be?
I would, obviously figure out where I'm going to vote early and just try and show up as early as possible, obviously with a mask because I'm not a monster, and distance as much as possible.
Is your usual polling place going to be open?
It is not. Not during early voting.
Okay.
I think I'm going to have to go to the new library, which is a voting center. So that'll be a first for me because I've actually never been to that library. It's beautiful. But I don't have that familiarity. I don't really know the layout.
Yeah, and that's why I'm asking. Because as far as, like, pandemic planning, like, let's say you go to this voting site and there's, like, a lot of people. I mean, there's just not a way to really be separate from people. Like, what would be your move there? I mean, how front of mind is COVID?
I would say vary just because I just want to get it over with. You know, I'd probably try and distance the best as I could and probably get a COVID test after.
I guess my last question to you would be, like, run through scenarios that would likely keep you from voting. Is there anything like getting sick, sort of scheduling issues? Like, what would be, like, a thing that could keep you from voting?
Yeah, I think getting sick. I wouldn't actively go out to a polling place if I were sick. That seems pretty irresponsible. I am childless and technically an essential worker just because we're reporters.
So it sounds like there's not, like, a lot that actually weighs on you when you think about voting. Like, this is pretty much a given. Your life is pretty easy, right? You're kind of have an ideal circumstance for someone who wants to vote this year.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a white dude in the United States of America, so very much steeped in privilege, and it extends to voting as well.
Yeah. Okay, so I want to talk about the other people who are considering to vote. So
please do.
Goodbye, Andrew.
Bye.
All right, so I want to talk about the kind of voters who actually have a lot of variables that could decide whether or not they vote. Tommy Bucer Clancy with the ACLU of Texas says these are his big worries.
What you fear is that some individuals in those long lines, you know, won't wait either because, you know, for a variety of reasons they can't, or they feel they can't, or they budgeted an ample amount of time, 2-3 hours, but for reasons that are not their fault, it's taking 5-6 hours.
Right. So most voters don't have an infinite amount of time to vote when they head to the polls. So a lot of factors could stand in the way of them getting this done in the time that they allotted. There's a risk, for example, of there not being enough polling sites. Because there's a pandemic, it's tough to find safe places to put a polling site. So people who watch elections have been worried that a lot of people will be condensed into fewer polling sites. Plus, it's also harder to find poll workers. If there aren't enough people to run a site, that means that site will likely have to close, which is another thing that Tommy Bucer Clancy is worried about.
It means that individuals aren't going to be able to cast their ballots because they don't have the time to get to whatever other polling locations will be open. Also, closing polling locations means that you're consolidating and all individuals, you know, now have to go to a fewer amount, which exacerbates the issues with longer lines.
Okay, so all of this is why it's impossible to guess what's going to happen when it comes to whether people will risk voting or will have the time to vote during a pandemic. And these are just some examples. Like we went through with Andrew, a lot of things like childcare, work, life could stop people from voting. Jim Henson is with the Texas Politics Project. He's a pollster, and he thinks a lot about voting behavior and who will or will not vote. And he says this lack of predictability or precedent during a pandemic is making an underlying part of the polls he creates kind of unreliable. This is something called turnout models, which are basically educated guesses that people like Jim Henson make about who will vote during an election.
You know, when you're trying to model voting behavior, you want to rely on historical patterns, historical precedents that you think have contribute some predictive value. And I think there are conditions this time, particularly in Texas, that you don't have any precedents for. And so you have, you know, the pandemic affecting people's judgment about how they're going to vote and whether they're going to vote.
So if a global pandemic wasn't enough of an X factor, Republicans in the state legislature actually threw in another a couple of years ago. They actually got rid of straight ticket voting. That's where you pick a party and the ballot is filled all the way down the ballot for you with that party instead of you having to go one by one through each race and pick a candidate. Henson says he has no idea what this will do.
You know, it's hard in Texas to calculate what the ballot roll-off is going to be in the absence of one-punch voting.
There is evidence that when other states eliminated straight-ticket voting, it had a significant impact on down-ballot races. But this has never happened in Texas before, so who knows? And in case this isn't clear, the Texas House elections are down ballot. This means there could be a scenario where there's really high turnout, but a lot of people just skip those House races. But again, who knows? I'll just end this by saying mostly everyone I talk to says this is likely to be a high turnout election. And that's based on the past two elections that happened here in Texas during the pandemic. That's the primary and the primary runoff where there was a spike in turnout, specifically among young people. But I'll say this again, this is just an educated guess and who knows what will happen. We'll find out in a few weeks whether Democrats have reached that major turning point in controlling state politics here in Texas. No matter which side you're on, this election and these specific races matter, and they could decide what politics in Texas looks like for the next decade or more.
In our final pre-recorded report, before we run the 60 Minutes segment about promising treatments for COVID-19, we have an NPR story, the effects of the coronavirus outbreak on the White House.
All right. As we know, President Trump is not the only person at the White House who's been laid up by the coronavirus. There is a cluster of cases tied to the White House, as Dr. Anthony Fauci told CBS News today.
We had a super spreader event in the White House, and it was in a situation where people were crowded together and were not wearing masks. So the data speak for themselves.
The scope of the outbreak has affected the way the White House is functioning. Campaign staffers have also been hit less than 4 weeks before the election. Here to talk about this is NPR White House reporter Aisha Roscoe. Hey, Aisha.
Hello.
So the president's condition is obviously all over the headlines, but what do we know about all the other people at the White House? How are they doing?
We know that more than a dozen people associated with the president have tested positive for the virus. You have Melania Trump, First Lady, and the president has said she's doing well. Her spokeswoman did not respond to a request for an update today. And you have a number of key officials who have contracted the virus and are working remotely, like White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany. Here she is on Fox News this morning.
Feeling great, no symptoms. The hardest part is being isolated from my little 10-month-old, but I'm feeling great, and I'm one of the blessed ones in this country to have an asymptomatic case of this.
Campaign manager Bill Stepien, who has the virus, but the campaign is still putting out statements in his name. He's supposed to be working remotely. Other top aides like Stephen Miller and Hope Hicks are also positive, as well as some of the more junior officials in the press office.
Now, I know, Aisha, from my own efforts to question people at the White House this week, that they're not being terribly forthcoming about all the other cases and how all this is affecting day-to-day operations. Are you having the same experience?
Yeah, they're offering very little, and often they'll cite privacy concerns. ABC News has reported that there's an internal document showing 34 associated cases from the White House. The Department of Health and Human Services and the White House have declined to comment on that report. But aside from that, people have been told to work from home if they can. So there's been a lot of adjustment going on. And the White House is trying to show that business is going on as usual. But there haven't been events, obviously, and not much has come out aside from videos of Trump and routine paperwork. And there are less people on the grounds. It's pretty quiet. There are not as many people in the West Wing as you normally would have.
All right, so that's the situation at the White House. How about for the campaign? How much is this slowing them down?
You know, before all of this happened, there was really a frenetic pace of announcements and events and travels. But, you know, and Trump is his own messenger. He's the big star of the campaign. That's all been shaken up now because of this, of Trump being out with some illness. But we do know that there will be a campaign rally with President Trump on Monday in Florida. And the White House is also planning to, this won't be a campaign event, but planning on holding an event tomorrow at the White House where President Trump will speak.
All right. That is NPR White House reporter Aisha Roscoe. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
In our final pre-recorded report, this is actually a 13-minute segment from 60 Minutes that aired last night. Scott Pelley reports on the most promising treatments for COVID-19 so far.
The president on Wednesday emerged from the White House hotspot to announce what he called a cure for COVID-19. With 23 days before the election, Mr. Trump said he became aware of the cure after ordering his doctors to give him an experimental drug. His idea, he said. No one but President Trump is claiming a cure for COVID-19. But labs around the world are racing to develop therapeutic drugs to reduce the severity of the disease. We're going to tell you about some of the most promising leads for treating COVID-19 today.
The story will continue in a moment.
When the lights dim, your photos won't. Samsung Galaxy S20 with Ultra Bright Night. Always big and bright, always Texas.
The president said this past week that we shouldn't be afraid of the virus.
Well, I think we should be fearful of what this virus could do to an infected person. Over 1 million people have died, and over 200,000 Americans have died. We have to give this virus its due respect.
If you don't know the name David Ho, your memory is too short. Dr. Ho led the team in the 1990s that created the cocktail of drugs that made HIV/AIDS survivable, even though there's still no vaccine.
Much of the world was going to be shut down.
His lab at Columbia University was still focused on HIV/AIDS until COVID-19.
You could say it's now worse than ever, with about 100,000 new cases per day worldwide. So we don't have it under control.
Ho's team moved into dorms vacated by students who are studying at home so they could work 24/7 on monoclonal antibodies, a complex name for a simple idea. A COVID patient's immune system creates antibodies to attack the virus. Those antibodies can be harvested, cloned, and reproduced in the billions.
For example, we could clone out 250-some antibodies from five infected persons, and then just systematically characterize them in the laboratory to see which ones have the best properties in terms of neutralizing or inactivating the virus.
How effective have monoclonal antibodies been?
They are promising. There are two front runners who have developed antibody. One is Eli Lilly and Company, and the other is Regeneron. And the president received the Regeneron product. These are very powerful antibodies, and both Lilly and Regeneron have reported promising preliminary results, but I must emphasize preliminary.
It's a cure. For me, I walked in, I didn't feel good. A short 24 hours later, I was feeling great. I went to
get out. It was antibody therapy from Regeneron Pharmaceuticals that Mr. Trump called a cure. But the facts are these. Last month, Regeneron and the Eli Lilly Company reported early results. In a small group of 275 patients, Regeneron showed a modest reduction in virus. In 452 patients, Lilly's antibodies reduced hospitalization from 6% to under 2%. What will it take to have more confidence in the results for monoclonal antibodies?
Well, these are ongoing studies. They, I think, are going to enroll thousands of these patients. They have only entered the clinic in June, July, so we need to give it more time.
Antibody clones are grown in massive tanks. Brewing millions of doses would be a vast industrial project and expensive. But if an antibody therapy is approved, each patient would likely need only one dose.
The antibodies are generally just given as an infusion of over 10, 15 minutes intravenously.
Is it clear that the monoclonal antibodies are safe?
Well, these two that have been administered now to a number of people, they don't seem to have any side effects. And in general, monoclonal antibody therapies for cancer, inflammation, and other diseases have been quite safe.
Now, labs, including David Ho's, are searching thousands of natural antibodies from patients to find lethal combinations against the virus. As a physician, if you could only have one, would you rather have a vaccine or an effective therapeutic?
I'd rather have an effective therapeutic.
All right, so you've been programmed to say that, right?
Few doctors know this disease as well as James Pruden, medical director of emergency preparedness for St. Joseph's Hospital in Paterson, New Jersey. Last spring, his hospital was overwhelmed with 456 COVID patients at once. The first one admitted was Dr. Pruden himself.
I got admitted to my own hospital. I'm one of the luckiest men on earth to be in a hospital where people are geared to do this, to resuscitate people and keep people alive.
The rate of death in the United States 7 months ago was double what it is today, in part because in the early days, so little was understood.
So it was a question of doing what you could, keeping this body alive while you tried to find out what protocol was working. And they did an excellent job. I was intubated twice, and I spent 31 days in the intensive care unit, lost about 80 pounds, could not roll over in bed on my own, could not sit up in bed on my own, and had the constant sense that I am not getting enough air.
And there was a sense of being hungry for oxygen.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Like drowning?
This was a question of my body, no matter what I do, is not pulling in enough air, and the oxygen that they're providing me is not giving me enough air, and I need air, I need air, I need air.
Dr. Pruden was so sick, briefly, word spread in the hospital that he had died.
I think she might need some help, Barbara.
In those early days, doctors didn't understand that the virus attacks the whole body, and many become critically ill 10 days after symptoms start.
They can go from being pretty healthy to needing a ventilator in minutes to hours.
Dr. Kevin Tracy heads the Feinstein Institutes for Medical Research at New York's largest private hospital system, Northwell Health. Why did those patients crash?
This is still an area of debate, but there seems to be several things going on. One is the virus grows very quickly in cells like endothelial cells, which line blood vessels, and this can cause a massive amount of cell death and blood clotting. Blood clotting can cause strokes and dysfunction in the brain and heart. These things, the virus and the tissue damage, can activate an immune response.
The immune response in some spins out of control. The body produces far too many chemicals called cytokines.
Cytokines are made by the immune system, are not by definition bad. Low levels of cytokines are important for wound healing and for immune, protective immune responses. The problem comes when the brakes on the system fail.
Do we understand why that occurs?
No, we do not understand why that occurs.
Overproduction of cytokines is lethal, which is why the president and others are given steroids to pump the brakes on the immune response. Steroids are among the therapies being studied in 3,500 clinical trials around the world, all targeting COVID-19.
In 10 weeks, we enrolled 1,200 patients into clinical trials. We would enroll that in a year for all of our trials.
Dr. Christina Brennan oversees Northwell Health's clinical trials, which include another drug given to the president, remdesivir. It's an antiviral developed in 2009 for hepatitis C, but it wasn't effective. It was tried on Ebola and, again, wasn't useful. But with COVID-19, the results may be different.
So far, it really has shown that it, you know, decreasing the hospital length of stay, but we haven't seen other effects that would say that it would cure COVID-19.
So it seems to make the patients better, makes their stay in the hospital a few days perhaps shorter, but hasn't been shown to eradicate the virus.
Correct. We did all of the COVID-19 trials. Yes.
Dr. Brennan told us she had patients in a 10-day treatment of remdesivir, but some went home in less than 10 days. Encouraging, but not a magic bullet. How long will it be before a person contracts COVID, they go to their doctor, they get a prescription, and they go home?
I think that could happen within the next year or two. I think that that day is inevitable. I think it's also inevitable that we will have a vaccine. I don't know the time course of either. It's like a horse race. There will be a winner of the race, but to pick on one now is very, very difficult.
And whatever drugs are developed may not work long. The virus mutates constantly. Dr. David Ho told us already the virus has many strains.
I think that's just like what we learned from HIV. The virus will adapt, and we will have to keep up with the virus.
Dr. Ho told us he has never seen the world's labs dedicate themselves to a single disease as they have for COVID-19. But every doctor we asked answered this question the same way. Would you rather have a mask or a vaccine?
A mask.
All this attention is being paid to vaccines, billions of dollars invested, and you'd rather have a mask. Why?
With our social distancing, wearing of the mask, the data is already showing that it's been effective. It's, you know, cost savings, and it's effective, and it can go a long way.
For a year or two, the mask will likely be the most effective tool. There's no cure and no way to know whether the president was helped by remdesivir or monoclonal antibodies or steroids.
And I went in, I wasn't feeling so hot, and within a very short period of time, they gave me Regeneron. It's called Regeneron, and other things too, but I think this was the key. But they gave me Regeneron, and it was like unbelievable. I felt good immediately.
We don't know why Mr. Trump settled on the Regeneron antibody therapy as the one to call a cure. It may be worth noting that in his 2017 financial disclosure form, Regeneron is listed as a stock he received profits from, but Regeneron was not listed in his 2020 disclosure. What did your colleagues here learn from treating you?
One of the things I've learned they learned is not to give up.
Dr. James Pruden, Director of Emergency Preparedness at St. Joseph's in New Jersey, was released after 33 days. He had to learn to walk again in physical therapy.
It felt like love. You never knew so many people cared. You know what I mean? That it was important to them that you come out. That's what it felt like.
Oh, okay.
Dr. Pruden and others told us the medical community is much better prepared now in case of another surge in the fall.
We're a lot smarter than we were 7 months ago. We are still not out of the woods.
As a physician and as a patient, what do you say to your medical colleagues about this going forward?
What I say to the medical colleagues is learn resilience, maintain physical strength and your cognition. Think, problem solve. It's not woe is me, but okay, how can I do it better the next time? And we can do it. There's strength in this community. There's strength and the world around us. Look at that strength and build on it.
And that is your coronavirus update for this Monday, October 12th, 2020, from the Recording Library of West Texas. I'm Michael. Coming up next, we'll bring you national news from USA Today. And then at 3 o'clock, local news. Here are some of the articles our volunteers will be reading this afternoon. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, nuclear waste storage in Andrews. Midlanders back Abbott's nuke opposition. Crude oil prices stay above $40. MISD sets special meeting to consider a new name for Lee. U.S. rig count rises for fourth straight week. Bob Fu, protests serve as a reminder of Fu's standing. Lee naming situation. Commentary, Midland should celebrate school's legacy with new name. Commentary, strength of MISD board's committee evident in balanced voting. MISD candidates to discuss issues at Facebook forums. Up for the debate. Hog. Stopping pandemic will restore economy and oil market. Pfluger. Protecting oil industry will bring back strong economy. And from the Odessa American, new incentives coming for ECISD teachers. Odessa College professors present at Education and Literacy Conference. Odessa IDEA campuses on track for fall 2021. DEF CON goes outdoors. Local haunting favorite taking a different route this year. Team effort leads to Odessa College student persistence. Former teacher turns her talent to Basin PBS. And guest view, flu shots are critical. Those stories and more coming up at 3 o'clock this afternoon. At 6 o'clock tonight, we'll bring you more national, international, with a focus on business news with the Wall Street Journal. Thank you very much for... Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter-Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
HEB, in partnership with Favor Delivery, started... Friday, a service that gives seniors access to a personal shopper by phone, allowing them to get essential food and supplies delivered to them while remaining in the comfort and safety of their home. Times are 9 a.m. to 1 p.m., 7 days a week. To access the senior support line, call 1-833-397-0080. Again, that number is 1-833-397-0080. To find out more about the program, visit favordelivery.com/senior.
If you're a do-it-yourselfer, don't let physical challenges limit your imagination. Each week, the guys on The Blind Handyman answer questions and offer tips on home maintenance and upgrades.
As we've pointed out several times, you do things when you're blind. Many times you do them the same way a sighted person would. A drill is a drill is a drill. A saw is a saw. And you just need to remember, don't get your fingers in it and push the board through it.
You want to make sure that your structure... we'll support this.
We're going to talk about an email that we had gotten about a stove ignition problem.
Assuming that you're blind, John, and you can't read a voltmeter, what do you want to do there?
Most of the new ones in the high-scale reading, it'll make a buzzing noise.
I'm going to talk about installing a micro hood. It's a combination microwave and vent hood.
And we've started drinking early. No, I'm not only kidding.
The Blind Handyman, direct from Lufkin, Texas. Monday nights at 7, Saturdays at noon, and Sunday nights at 11 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 74 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the upper 50s. Then tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-80s. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the upper 60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 2 p.m.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Hello. It is Monday, October 12th, and we're looking at the USA Today for this morning. The headline is, 1 million Americans could have votes tossed November 3rd. And there's a photo of an official ballot drop box. It looks like on a street corner somewhere. This is a story by Pat Beal and for USA Today. In a normal election year in any given state, hundreds or even thousands of absentee ballots get tossed for everything from late postmarks to open envelopes.